It's time for you to have a say. 203-333-9422. Now, back to the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600.
And welcome back to the show. Joining us now is Chief Anthony Campbell. He is the Assistant Police Chief at Yale, the former Police Chief in New Haven. This is the second time he's joining us for what will be a regular monthly segment. Hi, Chief. Welcome to the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
Of course, Lisa. Good to hear from you. How's everything going?
Good, 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 good. How's your August been? Did you get a chance to get away, get a vacation in July? Any summer
fun stuff? Believe
it or not,
I literally just returned from Florida. I was down near the Orlando area for a week visiting my wife's family. It was great to relax, and it's good to be back at work. Yeah.
It wasn't like hot as blazes down there?
Oh, it was ridiculous. I love the heat, but let me tell you, the heat down there is outrageous. 92, 93 every single day, and it feels like 106 degrees. So you go outside very briefly and then run back into the air conditioning or get into the pool.
Right. Florida would be nothing without the AC unit. Forget about it. If HVAC didn't exist, there'd be no Florida. It'd still be swampland. The alligators would be happy. So
exactly.
Chief Campbell, I really want to begin with a question for you as the Assistant Police Chief of Yale, someone with extraordinary experience in this. How are the local police enforcing this new recreational marijuana law in Connecticut? And specifically, I would like to know this. Are the police going to enforce public smoking of pot? In other words, if they see it, are they going to say, stop it? Are they going to give a ticket for it? What's going to happen with respect to that?
So it's a very gray area for us in the sense that now, as of July 1st, having 1.5 ounces of marijuana on you, an additional amount of marijuana locked in your glove compartment is allowed. People are allowed to use it publicly, to have it publicly, but many cities, New Haven included, have designated that there are certain areas they will not allow it to be smoked. So that is a challenge for law enforcement, because now you've got this state law that some cities and localities are now saying, but in particular areas, they will not allow it. Very similar to cigarette smoking, which is legal, mm-hmm. but many places stop it from being able to be done. So from an enforcement standpoint, what we are doing is now training the officers to understand that this new law is in effect, that we no longer are arresting people for having recreational marijuana. And we're really going to come from it from the standpoint of education, educating people where and when they can use this, that there are certain areas that they cannot use it. Also educating our officers that it is no longer a tool for enforcement. When we would typically pull someone over and we smelled marijuana in the vehicle, that was a reason to do a little more exploration and see if there was some criminal activity. No longer is that able to be done, because it's like cigarette smoke. Pull someone over and you smell a cigarette, that does not mean you can search that vehicle anymore. So we're going through.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. If you smell pot in a car, can't you make an inference that the driver might be driving under the influence? Cigarette smoke, nicotine is not a psychoactive substance, but cannabis is.
Yes. No, you can no longer use marijuana, the smell of marijuana, as an inference that that operator may be intoxicated or driving.
That's insane.
I agree.
That doesn't make sense to me.
Which is why many police chiefs, myself included, were not favorable towards the legalization of marijuana, because until we have certain standards in place, as we do with alcohol, where officers can be trained and use certain tools to determine whether a person is intoxicated or driving under the influence, those standards weren't put in place. So even though normally in the past, if I smell marijuana, I could get you out the vehicle, I could search the vehicle, I can no longer do that. Now what I have to
I can't believe what I'm hearing. You're telling me that it's still illegal to have an open container of beer in a car, for sure.
Correct.
And if you smell breath of a driver, that you can make an influence and pull them over, but that correct. If you open up a car, if someone is driving too slowly or too quickly or making too wide a turn or whatever it would be, they're driving erratically, and you smell pot, you cannot make an inference of somebody driving under the influence of a psychoactive substance? You're telling me that?
That is correct. What I will have to do is I will have to use other tools, such as the individual made that wide turn or the individual was driving too slowly. I can still get them out of the vehicle out of my concern for something that I observed, but I can no longer use the smell of marijuana to search that vehicle for an illegal substance, to search to see if there are weapons, et cetera. I cannot do that. I would have to observe the individual and see if there were things like slurred speech, other things that would lead me to bring them out and do a sobriety test. And the challenge is there are not a lot of trainings for officers that have been afforded to them with regard to testing a person. Unlike alcohol, I can, you know, breathalyze the individual, do the sobriety right. test, et cetera. We don't have that for marijuana. So someone having an ounce plus of marijuana on them, it gives off an odor. That no longer yes, is an does. Inference for me to be able to stop them. So it's a very gray area. A lot of education needs to go into bringing officers up to speed and also educating the public on what can and cannot be done. It's a challenge.
And at yeah. Yale, now I would like to talk about Yale, the ivory tower that it is. and it's its own, you know, very elitist, in my view, strange community. I'm just going to say that in some ways, because there's a lot of double standards around that community about a lot of different things. This is my own opinion, Officer Campbell.
Understood.
But how does that translate when you have a bunch of entitled, privileged kids who typically were not of the population anyway to be targeted when it came to marijuana? That's one of the realities of why people felt it was so important to legalize it, because they felt that so many other communities were targeted. But the kids at Yale, I'm going to guess, by and large, didn't feel that they were the targeted kids. How does the enforcement of the law itself translate into your policing at Yale?
Now, one of the fortunate things is that on college campuses, Yale is a private institution, but Yale also receives federal funding for certain things. And any university, any college campus that receives federal funding still has to obey federal law. And so although the new law that has gone into effect on July 1st allows people to have a certain amount of marijuana on them and use it recreationally in public, federal law does not allow any institution of higher learning to – there are laws that protect schools from having drugs, including marijuana, on the campus. And Yale's policies are very clear that drugs, alcohol, weapons are not allowed on campus. So even though the law is changing and we as Yale police officers do police the campus as well as some of the surrounding community, it really hasn't changed for us on campus. The students know that they cannot have marijuana of any sort on the campus, just as there are rules with regard to alcohol and its consumption on campus, just as there are rules against having weapons of any sort on campus. So it really doesn't change anything for us from an enforcement standpoint on campus.
We're chatting with Assistant Police Chief of Yale, Anthony Campbell, who is also the former New Haven Police Chief, and he knows quite a bit about our communities here. You know, it's interesting as I'm listening to you, because my son went to Northeastern University now going on about 15 years ago, something like that. And the stench of pot in the hallways was overwhelming. It was so unbearable, even for John, because he wasn't a pot smoker, that it really interfered with his life. And it was in the dormitories. It was unbearable.
Wow.
It was horrible. Yeah. So you're saying at Yale it's not so obvious and in your face, huh? It was at Northeastern 15 years ago.
Okay. Yeah, I could definitely tell you, A, having gone to this university as an undergraduate in the early 90s and also as a graduate, that was not something that I encountered. And I definitely was aware of the smell of marijuana because the community I came from, Harlem, New York, many people smoke marijuana. So I was very familiar with it. But it was not something I experienced here at Yale in my undergraduate years or when I attended graduate school here. And as an officer here, I really make it a point to make sure the officers, you know their beats, are familiar with the campus, familiar with the dorms. It's not a major complaint that we get. Has it happened in the past? Absolutely. But overwhelmingly, it is not a major complaint that we get.
Interesting. So, Chief Campbell, I want to talk about something else with you. There was a story, it came out of Michigan, but it could have come out of anywhere, right? But it did come in Michigan. And it was a story, it was on the Daily Beast this morning. And it's the story of a black realtor and his 15-year-old son, as well as the customer he was with. And they were showing a house. And somehow the police were called. It's not really clear, you know, who called the police or anything like that. But what is clear is that the people were immediately assumed to be trespassing and maybe burglarizing. And they were treated very roughly and very harshly by the police. And they are now making a national story of this, which is why it reached the Daily Beast, because they feel that they were unfairly profiled and that this is part and parcel of their experience as black human beings in this country. And I was wondering, from a policing point of view, what you thought of the story.
You know, I'm familiar with this story. And to your point, Lisa, this is a story that could have happened anywhere in these United States. And I think it goes to the heart of what many African Americans experience in this country, particularly when it comes to housing or freedom of movement in this country. You've got a realtor who is black who is showing a property. And while he's showing that property, he's inside the property. The client notices that there are a lot of police officers outside, basically around the property, pointing weapons towards the property. They make contact with the person, with the actual client, and they talk from the second floor window with the client and tell them, we need you to come outside with your hands up. And I think this goes to the heart of something in policing that is really needs to change. Far too often, the policies that govern how we do the work we do don't always take into account cultural competency. If you are a police officer and you are policing a diverse community and you come into contact, someone calls you, I think a home is being burglarized, you come into contact with an individual on the second floor window who tells you they're a real estate agent and they're African American, a little bell should go off in your head like, A, I want to maintain a relationship with all members of the community.
True.
This individual is a person of color in this community. And yes, I've been called here, but I've got resources here. We're safe. Let's slow this down. Let's de-escalate the situation. The officers could have, rather than having the individuals come out, handcuffing the realtor, handcuffing the client's son, who was 15
years
old.
Their guns drawn on them. What kind of thing is that?
Now, what they could have done, rather than having their guns drawn, they could have taken up protective positions. The officer could have had the one individual come out or throw his identification out the window, and they could have had a conversation. The officer, once he verified that this was a realtor, could have gone in with another officer, verified that things were safe, and they could have slowed things down. They could have de-escalated the situation.
Yeah. That's
one of the things that was said by a supervisor of the department who commented on this situation, he said that the officers followed the policy of the department. And I don't like the Monday morning football work that's done by other police officers, but one thing I could tell you is this. In policing, culture trumps policy all day. And it is the culture of policing that when you go on a call and you have your weapon drawn and you put people in handcuffs. Sometimes I think departments need to start de-escalating situations and change the culture of their department. A policy is there to ensure that things are done safely and correctly, but it does not trump common sense. If the gentleman upstairs tells you that he's a realtor, then do what you need to verify that. You didn't need to put the people in handcuffs because you've got the numbers there. You've got officers there that if anything happens, you can handle your business. Now, if they hadn't put them in handcuffs, if they had verified from the window, if they had done this a little bit differently, they could have established a relationship rather than now having made a major withdrawal on their credibility in that in the community. And think about that 15-year-old son who watched his father be put in handcuffs, who himself was put in handcuffs. That individual is not going to view the police in the same way ever again, as are the two adults who were put in handcuffs. And that to me is where the real tragedy comes.
It's a scar. It's a trauma. 100%.
Exactly. And it's a scar for those three individuals, but it's a scar for the larger community of color. I think there was a better way to do that. And so we here at the university, as well in New Haven when I was the chief, and many other chiefs here in Connecticut and throughout this country, are focusing on cultural competency, helping our officers to understand it's not just how you police, but also understanding who you're policing and what's going on in this world right now in this country. And also de-escalation. Slow it down. Make the connection in the first 30 seconds of interaction. Be tactically sound, but at the same time, make sure you respect a human being's rights under the Constitution and their humanity. And it can be done. It really can be done.
We're chatting with Police Chief Anthony Campbell. Chief, you know, it strikes me as I'm listening to you that I grew up, and it was already, you know, old. But do you remember the Andy Griffith Show?
Of course. Of course. Okay. Of course.
Do you know that it was one of the longest running television shows in American history? It ran from black and white, you know, to color. We watched Opie grow up in front of our eyes and Aunt Bee. And the running premise of the show was that Chief Taylor, right, he didn't get riled or crazy or jump to conclusions or put his gun, but his deputy, Barney Fife, right, was always trigger happy. And the running premise of the show was that Barney Fife was an idiot. He was an idiot. In other words, he probably never should have been a police officer to begin with. And one of the tensions was that Andy Griffith was always trying to make sure that the hothead didn't get the best of the situation. And he would always come in and he'd be calm about it and he'd give the people the benefit of the doubt. And he was Mr. De-escalation. And I almost think that ought to be required watching again for people, because that was the image of the police that I grew up with, that they were automatically the de-escalators. And I think something went wrong in this country in the last 10 or 20 years. Maybe it's too many other television dramas where everything has to be so heightened. Maybe it's 9/11, a perception of fear. But for much of my life, the average police officer, in my mind's eye, was the Andy Griffith, not the Barney Fife.
Yes. And, you know, Lisa, I'm so glad you brought that example up. It's an example that so many of us are familiar with. I do think that, you know, the example of Sheriff Taylor is a great example, because he always acknowledged the humanity of the people he was policing before he went to the tactics. And as you said, Barney Fife would always, you know, draw his weapon, be very nervous.
Right. Your sympathy, your understanding was that effective policing was de-escalating, that's what it was about.
And I think that today policing is, you know, is cyclical. I think we're finally, in many ways, because of race relations and attention has been brought to how we do policing, thanks to body cameras, thanks to everyone in the country having a cell phone that can video record, we're finally getting back to a place where we understand that how we've been doing policing has not really been the right way to do it for all people in this country. We're getting back to the history of policing and what policing really should be for all people in this country. And that really is about de-escalation. It's about making sure that the wellness of every member of the community is taken into account. And it doesn't mean that you have to do soft law enforcement. You can still enforce the law, but it's not just about enforcing the law. It's how you do it. It has been statistically shown that you can pull a person over and not give them a ticket, but the way you treat them makes them feel so bad that they really want nothing to do with police. And you can pull the same person over and give them a ticket, but treat them with dignity and respect, and they still will feel good about police. It's how you do things, not just what you do, but how you do it. And I think that the example you gave, it's really about de-escalating, slowing things down, and making the connection with the people you police. I've arrested people, put them in handcuffs. I've unfortunately had to take away people's freedom. But the way I did it, I always acknowledge a person's humanity, talk to them with respect, explain to them what I was doing and why I was doing it, and made sure that everyone who was in my circle around me, officer-wise and civilian-wise, understood that this was a relational transaction. I think if we could get back to that, you'll have far fewer stories like the one we discussed before, because I think that's what true community wellness is about.
Yeah, it is. And I, you know, we could go on, but I think we had this demarcation point when we militarized the police, when we sent them SWAT uniforms, when we gave them, you know, sort of like machine gun like kind of weaponry, where we allowed our excess military, you know, materiel to go to local police. I think we went crazy. In this country.
We definitely did, Lisa. And I think it also went hand in hand with, you know, the Nixon administration back in the day making a declaration of a war on drugs. By doing that, we basically said that we would use law enforcement as tools to wage a certain type of war on our communities. And that was never the intention of law enforcement in this country. And I think slowly but surely, we're now waking up to the reality that we have to get away from that and make police officers the go-to, most approachable people in the community to help solve problems. We will never arrest our way out of making a better community. Truthfully, arrests indicate that the type of policing you're doing really is not effective. The true mark of a safe, healthy community is when you don't have crime and when you don't have the need for so many police officers. And I think part of the escalation and getting back to our roots of what policing should be, we're slowly but surely making our way back there.
Okay, well, Chief Anthony Campbell, you're such a star. You are such a star. I'm so delighted to be chatting with you. Thank you for joining us for a regular segment on the show, and we look forward to your commentary in a few weeks, as no doubt we'll have something else to talk about. But thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Chief Anthony Campbell.